Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Edith Harold, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups with the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this FedSoc Forum called This Land is My Land, Utah's Supreme Court Challenge to the Federal Land Ownership. Speaking on the panel today, we have Ethan Blevins, a legal fellow at the Pacific Legal Foundation, and David Wilms, the Associate Vice President of Public Lands at National Wildlife Federation. We're also joined by Jonathan Wood, the Vice President of Law and Policy at the Property and Environment Research Center, who will be moderating our discussion today. If you'd like to learn more about today's moderator or speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. Throughout the program, we may turn to the audience for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers and not the Federalist Society. With that, Jonathan, thanks for joining us today, and I'll hand things over to you.
Thank you, Edith, and thank you to the Federal Society for hosting this webinar. Today, we'll be discussing an interesting case that has been filed in the U.S. Supreme Court and that could affect the status of hundreds of millions of acres of federal land in the western U.S. In August, the state of Utah filed a motion with the Supreme Court seeking to file a complaint against the United States under the court's original jurisdiction. Utah challenges the federal government's constitutional authority to own and indefinitely retain land and demands the disposal of 18.5 million acres of land it characterizes as, quote, unappropriated, unquote. The United States, joined by the Ute Indian tribe, has urged the Supreme Court to reject jurisdiction in the case. And on the merits, the United States argues that the property clause permits the federal government to own and retain lands. As Edith mentioned, we're joined by two excellent speakers today. Ethan Blevins is a legal fellow at the Pacific Legal Foundation and David Wilms at the National Wildlife Federation. And Ethan, I believe we decided you're going to go first and present your perspective on the side of Utah.
Thanks very much, Jonathan, and thanks to the Federal Society. I'm excited to chat about this important topic and learn from David as well. So today we are talking about whether the federal government has a legal obligation to dispose of a portion of the lands it owns and manages in the western states. I want to offer a brief caveat first. I had the privilege of growing up on the doorstep of two major national parks in Jackson, Wyoming, and I could see the Tetons out my living room window. But most of my childhood, I was not looking out that window. I was looking at my PlayStation game. And now I live right outside the Wasatch Range in Salt Lake City. And the only thing that has changed is that I'm now on the fifth generation of the PlayStation. So I only give that as a caveat because I think David and Jonathan probably understand our public lands much better than I do. And I'm looking forward to learning from them. I do hope to provide some perspective on what the Constitution has to say about federal ownership of public land. And I'm going to try to frame the issue objectively, and then I'll give some of my thoughts on it. The federal government owns just over half of the land west of the Rockies. This is over 600 million acres. It's a lot of land. In several states, the federal government owns most of the land. This includes Utah. So in Utah, about 70% of land mass is owned and managed by the federal government. This includes national forests, national parks, Indian lands, and then there's a lot of land that is not dedicated to a specific purpose. It's just managed by the Bureau of Land Management and under federal control and ownership. And it's important to understand that that's what we're talking about when we're talking about this Utah case. We're going to talk a little bit about what this might mean for national forests and national parks, I hope, but Utah is claiming that it's that last category I mentioned, the BLM, Bureau of Land Management, managed land that the federal government, according to Utah, has to dispose of because they haven't dedicated it to a specific federal purpose. Now, the federal government is not just any typical landowner. It operates as a sovereign over the land it owns. So it adopts all sorts of rules and regulations governing how the land is used. It's not just stuff like no shirts, no service that a property owner can normally do. It's things like what constitutes a crime, how the land can or cannot be used or developed. In effect, it operates like the state legislature or the county council would over its land. It is effectively using the sort of police power you'd expect to be used by the states. Now, the Western states do not like this. They cannot tax the federally owned land. They cannot exercise eminent domain over it, and they don't get exclusive sovereign control over it. So federal law and regulations obviously going to preempt the state laws when it comes to how this land is used. And they have complaints about a variety of complaints about how the Bureau of Land Management manages this land. And in a lot of states, as I mentioned, it's the majority of the land. There's a long history here of states and feds fighting over this land. And the state of Utah has penned the most recent chapter very recently by filing an original action in the United States Supreme Court. And their claim is that about 18 million acres of land in Utah needs to be disposed of by the federal government because it's this Bureau of Land Management land we were talking about earlier. And they argue that their main argument, they muster a few constitutional arguments that we can go into in depth, but the main one is that this relatively obscure section of the Constitution, the property clause in Article 4 of the Constitution, requires the feds to dispose of land that it is not dedicating to fulfilling or furthering some enumerated power. And now this is more than a turf war between the states and the federal government. It's ultimately really about individual liberty and democratic accountability, because we have this system of separated powers. We divide up power with understanding that that allows the governed to control the government. And I believe, and I think Utah believes, that widespread ownership and control of land by the federal government imperils that system of separated powers. For one thing, the sort of most fundamental principle in the Constitution is that the federal government is one of enumerated power. So if it's not enumerated and specified in the Constitution, the federal government can exercise whatever power that they're trying to exercise, then the rest of that power is reserved to the states. And we typically call that sort of this grab bag power, the police power. And the Supreme Court has said time and again that the federal government does not have a police power. It only has these enumerated powers. But what it does on these federal lands, hundreds of millions of acres of land in the West, is effectively exercise a police power. And I think that's a problem. The state legislatures and the state governors exercise the same sort of police power that the federal government is exercising, except in the case of Utah, the federal government is exercising that police power over more land than the state legislature itself is. And this is a problem of basic democratic accountability. The local constituents in Utah or in Nevada, where the federal government owns 80% of the land, have less say over what happens on that land than a Massachusetts senator who might have some policy preferences about how the federal lands are used. And I think this is a problem. This is not the democratic structure we signed up for with the Constitution. There are major policy trade-offs we're talking about with regard to how this land is going to be used, what constitutes a crime on that land, and so forth. And when we have these value-laden trade-offs, we typically leave that to the democratic process. But for the most part, these lands are governed by federal bureaucrats, not even Congress, which has delegated an extraordinary amount of discretion to the Bureau of Land Management to decide what is criminal activity on this land, how the land can be developed or used. If we want a democratically accountable government, these decisions really should be being made by the state legislatures. And that's why Utah wants this land to be disposed of, because then they will again have sovereign control over it. It'll be back under the democratic accountable control of the state legislature and governor. So in the end, I suppose, if this webinar were a Dungeons and Dragons campaign, I'd be the lawful neutral character who says, like, you know, whether we slay the wicked goblins or not, I don't care as long as we keep the rules, right? So the rules are there in order to create accountability. Whatever we end up doing with that land, it should be up to the local constituents and not up to a federal bureaucrat who really right now is the only sheriff in town for most of Utah and most of Nevada and Idaho and many other states that have a substantial amount of federal ownership. And with that, I'll turn it back to you, Jonathan.
Thanks, Ethan. And I hope the case will inspire you to get out and touch grass. I said that right. That's how the kids say it. Anyway, I've never felt so old. David, your opening statement.
Thanks, Jonathan. And thank you, Ethan, for your perspective and to the Federalist Society for the invitation to participate in this webinar. And, no place I'd rather be than the end of my holiday vacation and with all of you. I want to start my remarks today by, I actually want to express a deep appreciation and sympathy for the series of events that have led Utah to feel as though it was necessary to seek judicial relief from the U.S. Supreme Court. Over the course of 12 years serving as a senior assistant attorney general for the state of Wyoming and as a natural resource policy advisor for the former governor of Wyoming, Matthew Mead, I witnessed firsthand the challenges and deep frustration born out of these strained relationships between the state and the federal government over decisions that are affecting land and water and wildlife contained within our sovereign borders. And under this system that we've operated under for generations, it's difficult and often seemingly impossible task to both manage lands and wildlife in a way that is for the common benefit of the United States, as well as the state and local communities where the land, water, and wildlife are. And I think Ethan did a nice job of explaining some of that tension, some of that constitutional tension. And because of this, it's really no surprise to me that a state like Utah with significant federal land holdings would find themselves in greater conflict with the federal government than other states. That said, I'm going to take the position, maybe trying, I wanted to come in being super neutral and probably not. I'm of the opinion that the appropriate forum to try and address Utah's grievances is actually through Congress and not the legal system. That the property clause of the United States Constitution actually vests Congress with two related but distinct powers: the power to manage property owned by the federal government and the power to dispose of such property. And there's a mountain of case law established over nearly 200 years of history that supports the absolute power in Congress over each of these distinct powers. So if a state like Utah has concerns about how the federal government is either managing or disposing of its property, the appropriate venue to address that concern is with Congress, unless the government is violating laws or regulations approved by Congress concerning the management or disposal of lands, which isn't what Utah alleges in its bill of complaint. Utah's principal claim is that it is unconstitutional for the federal government to own property in perpetuity that is not expressly enumerated in the Constitution. Utah claims that the Enclave Clause is the only place where such power is enumerated, and that it only includes, and I'm generalizing a little bit, but it falls into these categories of, it really only includes military installations in Washington, D.C. It also claims that the Necessary and Proper Clause allows holding property to the extent that it is needed for the use of the government in the execution of any of its enumerated powers. To me, this argument seems pretty clear, that if property isn't held from one of these enumerated powers to support one of these, then in Utah's position, it's unconstitutional to own them in perpetuity. However, Utah muddies its argument a bit in its brief when it states that it is unconstitutional for the federal government to own unappropriated lands in perpetuity. And it uses this term in a, I view, a confusing way, but likely designed to avoid public backlash that would occur if the public thought Utah was seeking ownership of national parks, monuments, forests, and the like. As Utah defines unappropriated lands as those lands that are not actively used or designated for federal purposes, which in Utah's interpretation means the 18.5 million acres of land currently managed by the Bureau of Land Management in Utah. Yet, despite arguing that the only enumerated powers to own land in perpetuity are limited to Washington, D.C. and military installations, Utah then claims that it's somehow constitutional to own national parks, forests, wildlife refuges, wilderness areas, wild and scenic rivers, monuments, national conservation areas, because Congress designated or reserved them for a specific purpose. In my review, I found that Utah's definition of unappropriated lands is really not supported in federal law and undermines Utah's broader constitutional claim. Because if perpetual federal land ownership is inherently unconstitutional, as Utah contends, then whether land is appropriated or unappropriated is irrelevant. The very distinction contradicts their argument and highlights a lack of internal coherence in their legal reasoning there. And I'd state it slightly different way, which is if Utah's argument is that it is unconstitutional to own land except Washington, D.C. and military installations, and land necessary and proper to achieve those enumerated powers of military installations and Washington, D.C., then it should also be unconstitutional to own national parks, forests, and the like. It's hard to have it both ways. And I think the brief shows and the argument shows a struggle with that, like an internal struggle with that in trying to argue that. Of course, as I mentioned before, in my view, the Constitution actually supports the federal government owning land indefinitely pursuant to the property clause, not just the enclave clause. The relevant language from the property clause is quite simple, that Congress shall have the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. And as I mentioned before, this language vests Congress with two related but distinct powers, power to manage property owned by the federal government, power to dispose of such property. And as I'm assuming we'll get into our discussion, there's a lot of case law that talks about and confirms that Congress has this complete power over public lands under the property clause, which includes the power to regulate, retain, and manage these lands indefinitely. Also, that it has the power to sell lands or withhold them from sale. Utah seems to suggest that the property clause creates a limitation on federal authority over public lands, that limit being the ability to manage them up and until they are disposed of. In fact, the state suggests that the federal government is constitutionally obligated to dispose of federal lands because the clause does not contain the word retain. However, and I'm not the constitutional scholar, so I'm setting this up and hoping that Ethan and I can have a fun discussion about this. If our founders really wanted the federal government to divest from all federal lands, it would have been far more explicit in the property clause. It could have simply said that Congress shall dispose of property rather than say it has the power to dispose of property. I'd argue that having the power to do something is not a mandate that such action must occur. I think we'll get into this. There are a couple of other arguments Utah made, but just looking at my time and how we want this conversation to go, maybe that'll come up later. I think there's some conversations about the equal footing doctrine and how states come in to the union and you know what states give up when they come into the union that I think they're central to this. This potential case as well. I guess I'd leave it with my final thought is I'd like to have a discussion as well around the broader implications of what might happen with this case. If the court were to side with Utah, that decision could upend the federal framework for managing public lands. It could lead to a cascade of similar lawsuits from other states and could ultimately jeopardize 640 million acres of land. It could result in widespread privatization. It could reduce public access. It could result in lost revenue for states and the federal government. It could result in the end of family ranches that depend on large, affordable tracts of public land to stay in business, produce food for the country. It could drive up the cost of energy and many other unintended consequences. Or it might do the opposite of that, right? The point is, we don't know. It's why I reiterate my earlier point that the appropriate remedy for Utah to address some of its concerns is through the powers vested in Congress and not the courts. And I'll stop there and pass it back to you, Jonathan.
Thank you, David. And thank you to the audience members that have already started posting questions. Please do post there, though I'm going to exercise moderator privilege and ask a few of my own first, but I'm monitoring that. We'll add in those questions too. So first, picking up on David, your sort of expression of sympathy for the position Utah's in, I wonder if either of you or both of you could say a little bit about how we got here. If you don't live in the Intermountain West, this case probably seems to come out of nowhere. Why Utah? Why now? And what got us to this point?
I'm happy to start that, Ethan, and then you can if that works for you. Perfect. So I think you can, it depends on how far back you want to go. But I think where I will start this is probably, you know, in the midpoint of the 20th century. And, you know, and maybe I'll go back a little bit farther. For a long time, this country had and Utah rests some of its argument on this, had a policy, a lot of policies actually around the transfer or sale or bequeathing of public lands to members of the public, to corporations, to states, to facilitate the expansion of the country from east to west. You had Homestead Act, you had railroad bequeaths of land. You had thanks for your service for military veterans. There were a whole host of reasons why we had a number of policies that led towards the transferring federal land out of the federal estate into other interests. And starting in the mid to late 1800s, we started to see reservations of those lands for other purposes. We saw the establishment of the national parks. We saw forest reserves created. We saw wildlife refuges. We saw the national forest system. We saw national monuments. The Taylor Grazing Act came into place to firm up how we manage some of these lands for grazing. And it ultimately led to I would call a seminal moment in the 1970s, where we created a policy that went from maybe 200 years of seeking to transfer ownership in other places to making a once and for all policy that actually what we have in the federal estate, we largely want to keep in the federal estate. And that caused that initial policy change started to cause some ripple effects in the West, in particular where a lot of these large land holdings were. And you saw the rise of what we'd call the Sagebrush Rebellion, where you had these conflicts between states and local communities and individuals and the federal government and how lands are managed. And through the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, which is this 1976 law that I was mentioning, that established this policy of retaining land in federal ownership. It also came with it requirements of land use planning for multiple uses and limits on how you dispose of land. That led to, inherently, when you have multiple uses, you have a lot of people, a lot of different interests that create a lot of tension on how you're going to manage lands. And then fast forward, I'd say maybe some of the breaking points actually came towards the end of the Clinton administration, the end of the Obama administration, with the use of the Antiquities Act and the creation of Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument and Bears Ears National Monument, totaling over 3 million acres in southeast Utah. And that was done largely over the objections of the state and local communities. And I think that kind of brought it to this simmer to a boil, and it led to some state actions in Utah, passing some laws calling for the transfer, hiring a firm to do a legal analysis on the merits of pursuing transfer. Those final events, I think, led to that boil over, where it felt like from the state's perspective, they were left with no other option but to pursue some sort of a legal remedy. But Ethan, that was a rambling, and I probably missed a bunch of stuff, and you may have some things you want to fill in.
You're a very thorough answer, and I'll just add a couple things. One is this really seminal case in the 1970s. It was really part of what Dave was talking about with the Sagebrush Rebellion, which was called Kleppe versus New Mexico, which is actually worth reviewing a little bit because it's in many ways so emblematic of the conflicts that are going on here. This was a conflict over the Wild Free Roaming Horses and Burros Act that was adopted by Congress that said, on public lands, the federal government's going to manage these growing and larger herds of wild horses and burros. New Mexico ranchers were getting frustrated because the burros would wander off public lands. They, believe it or not, don't respect those borders. And they'd eat the livestock's feed and disrupt the livestock. And so the ranchers said, hey, New Mexico Livestock Board, please remove these. And they did so. And the federal agency said, nope, we're going to, you know, you can't remove those under this act of Congress. And the act was challenged and upheld. And the federal government's, that was when the United States Supreme Court said really clearly, federal government's not just a proprietor. It doesn't just own land. And the language of CLEPI says literally that the federal government is also a legislature with respect to these lands. And so I think that while that had been going on for a while, this was a turning point, I think, in the way these lands were understood and seen. There were years where things were going just fine. Early practice did allow, for example, for the state to exercise eminent domain over some of these federally controlled lands. That's no longer the case. So there was a gradual shift, but that was a major turning point where the federal government's exercising more and more sovereign control over the land rather than just being seen as a property owner. And just to also maybe go back even further to very early history, the first three states to come into the union following the original 13, the federal government ceded its territory to the states. And that was just a matter of course. And then after that, the federal government realized it was losing a lot of money. This was valuable land. It could be used to pay off all these debts. And so starting, I think, with Ohio, they started requiring these disclaimers in the Enabling Acts, which we can talk about in more depth because I think it's interesting and important, but where they required the states to disclaim any title to the federally owned lands. But it wasn't because the federal government at the time wanted to retain them. It's because they wanted to sell them because they were very valuable. So at that early stage, there was still this presumption that the land was going to be disposed of. And then I think David's, of course, correct that in 1976, that changed. There was a formal adoption of policy that sort of fossilized the current land ownership status and said, we're going to presume that we're going to hold on to these lands unless the Department of Interior finds it in the national interest to dispose of them. And that's where things have stand ever since.
Thank you both. Turning to an audience question, someone picks up the question David teed up that I think I'll direct to Ethan. Where does this unappropriated line come from? And is there any constitutional basis for it? Do you expect it to stand up? Or is David right that this is a political marketing tactic?
I come somewhere in the middle here. I agree with David that it's a difficult line to toe. I think if we root it in fundamental constitutional principles, it makes a little bit more sense, which is to say, hey, you know, the federal government has this list of enumerated powers. If it's exercising power that is not pursuant to any of those powers, then we're outside the scope of the necessary and proper clause, and we're in a zone where the federal government's exercising authority that should be reserved to the states. And we look at how these BLM lands are being managed. They're, you know, BLM is doing things like determining how long, or this is probably National Park Service regulation, but still, how long a leash has to be. You know, if you go beyond for your dog, if you go beyond that, you're violating federal regulation. There was a Nevada case over BLM regulations regarding taillights, where a dirt biker did not have a taillight that was required by federal regulation and was slammed with multiple felony counts. Interestingly, the federal district court in Nevada said this is a non-delegation violation because BLM should not be have the authority to decide what constitutes a crime with respect to traffic laws. That's not something that a federal agency should be doing. I also don't think it's something that Congress should be doing. We typically think of that as exercise of state power. So what the core of this distinction is, are they exercising an enumerated power with respect to these lands? If they are not, then they are not within the scope of the enumerated powers granted to the federal government. Where it gets tricky is, I think David alluded to this, well, then it begs the question, right, of what enumerated power is the federal government exercising when it manages national forests and national parks, especially because it does very similar things sometimes. The national forests Service leases its lands just like BLM leases its lands for various purposes. So does this argument actually implicate the National Parks and National Service that National Forest Service that Utah is trying to exclude? I think under, you know, very loose understanding of the Commerce Clause that we currently live under, you could say, well, these parks and forests facilitate interstate tourism. And so it's connected to the commerce power, or, you know, because some of these parks and forests straddle state lines that they implicate interstate commerce. I personally don't think that's a very good interpretation of the Commerce Clause. So I think if we were to really be robust with our limited interpretation of the commerce power and robust about what it means to keep the government, federal government, enclosed within its enumerated powers, then maybe this distinction that Utah's making is hard to make. But as the Constitution stands now with a broad understanding of the commerce power, I think it's reasonable. It's not crazy to say, you know, BLM is allowed to do whatever it wants with these unappropriated lands. They've been given huge discretion by the Federal Land Policy Management Act, whereas these national parks, national services, they have a specific dedicated purpose that maybe fits within the commerce power. Indian lands, by the way, I think are easier, right? Because there's very specific powers given over Indian lands in the Constitution to the federal government. But it is tougher to distinguish, I think, between national parks, for example, and unappropriated land.
So I'd like to just add one. I want to focus specifically on the term unappropriated land, sort of the origins of it. And, you know, it's, I don't think it's necessarily tied to anything constitutionally. I'm not going to argue with Ethan's arguments on this, but what I will say is, when you look back at where unappropriated lands is used in the context under which it's used, it's typically found, well, it's found in almost every enabling act for a new state that enters the Union post-Ohio. And in that enabling act, it's giving up the right, the state is giving up all claims to all unappropriated lands within the sovereign boundaries of that new state that's going to enter the Union. When you look at that and you look at other contexts of the use of unappropriated land at the time, at the various times states were admitted, and even going back farther, it typically just refers to non-privately held land. That's the simplest way to describe it. Land that's not held by a private individual or corporation would be unappropriated land. And in some of the enabling acts that allowed states to come into the Union, you know, one of the things that these enabling acts did is they gave, in exchange for relinquishing all claims to all lands within the state, the federal government then gave the state sections out of a certain number of sections out of each township in the state, right? So anywhere from 1 to 4 sections. Utah got 4 sections. State I'm in, Wyoming, got 2 sections. Some states that were admitted earlier only received 1 section of lands. I found it kind of interesting. And I actually haven't spent the time to think this through to its what it actually means. So I'm going to put this out there with anything legal to actually support this claim. But in Wyoming's Enabling Act that did this, it effectively said, you can have these lands in these township and ranges on the unappropriated lands of the state, except for Yellowstone National Park, which at the time of admission had already been established by Congress in Wyoming. So it was almost as though they were saying Yellowstone National Park is unappropriated land because it's not already privately held. But we're through this Enabling Act, we're carving out this specific place where you can't actually receive any of these additional properties upon entrance to the Union. You can't receive the sections out of the townships in there, because even though it's unappropriated, we've set it aside for this other purpose. I look at it as it's because of that, because of the context of it, and because unappropriated lands really was just non-privately held lands, it's really hard for me to then turn around and read a brief where the state narrows this term to be just these 18 and a half million acres of BLM lands that have not been, quote, designated for some other purpose. I can't find anything where it's really tied to anything. And if when you actually go back and see what the common meaning that was at the term, it really should be all federal lands.
Thank you. Turning to another audience member question, I think this might be, David, your opportunity to bring up the equal footing doctrine, which expressed interest in, but the Supreme Court in the last few years expressed interest in the role of history and practice in constitutional interpretation. If you look at the map of the United States, it's almost like you have two histories. You have disposal on the eastern half, retention on the western half. How does that shake out for purposes of interpreting the history and tradition of the property clause and the establishment of states?
I was going to look to our constitutional scholar.
I can offer some brief thoughts. I mean, one is that there's this interesting case, 1849, called Pollard versus Hagen. It's not been overruled. It's not been abrogated. It's just sitting there, in which the United States wanted to claim a public thoroughfare across all navigable waters in Alabama and say, Alabama, you can't tax it. You can't regulate it. Can't do anything with it. It's ours. And the United States Supreme Court rejected that. And one of the things they said repeatedly in that case is, well, this would put Alabama on an entirely different footing than these other states, which have, you know, open sovereignty over all their entire jurisdiction. And we're concerned about that. Now, they didn't like formally cite and rely upon the equal footing doctrine, but that's essentially the concept they seem to be evoking. So the equal footing doctrine, in its simplest terms, says, you know, states should enter into the union on equal terms with each other. As anybody who's a student of the convention knows, the states were very jealous of each other. They really cared about power imbalances. They wanted to do away with them as much as possible. And that's where the equal footing doctrine comes in. The response is, look, you know, you have these enabling acts that say the same things. It just happens to be that, as a sort of accident of history, that there's more federal land on your, in your jurisdiction than others. And I think that's, it's well taken. It's, the equal footing doctrine, I think, is a bit of a tougher argument, in my opinion, for the state of Utah. But we have this Pollard versus Hagen case that seems to say, look, we're worried about the imbalance this creates when the federal government owns a substantial amount of territory and manages it to exclusion of the state because of the supremacy clause. So that's just my thought. But go ahead, David.
I guess two things. One is on the Pollard case, and maybe Ethan, you might be able to answer this more because I don't know it really well, but I do understand that it's been narrowed quite a bit. The impact of it has been narrowed quite a bit over time, with, even though it hasn't been overturned, and it's really been, you know, high water marks of the bed and banks to high water, up to the high water marks of navigable rivers. It's been very narrowed, and arguably, you know, does it apply to other things, or is it just to that very specific set of circumstances? I think that's potentially debatable. And I tend to agree with you. I think it's a tougher argument. The equal footing doctrine, I think, is a tougher argument for Utah. But the only other point I'd make is, I think the equal footing doctrine guarantees that each state upon admission to the union has the same legal and political standing as the original 13 states. Meaning equal political and sovereign rights, but it doesn't mean that every state must have identical economic resources, geographic characteristics, land ownership structures, which, because of the very nature of how different every state is in size and geography and economics, that it really makes it, in my mind, makes a tough argument.
Well, picking up on that point, one of the audience questions is whether the sovereignty really is different. So if you're Massachusetts and have sovereignty over all your land, are you in a different position than Utah is, having only sovereignty over 30% of the land because of the federal authority? And I mean, could you have hypothetically a state that had zero sovereignty because all the land were federal? I wonder, David, maybe I'll start with you. Like, what, if you have any thoughts about whether the nature of the sovereignty between these states really is affected by the presence of federal land?
Well, I think there's some case law that suggests that at least for, in certain instances, it's been limited, particularly with respect to taxing authority. We have case law that's really established that the state doesn't have the ability to tax federal land, and through FLTMA, the Federal Land Policy Management Act, Congress set out to try and address that issue. I think it was through there. It might have been through something else. I apologize if I messed that up. But it was the creating the payment in lieu of taxes system to try and compensate local communities, counties for lost revenue from the inability to be able to assess tax. And there's kind of a debate on the effectiveness of that. I think some counties receive more than they probably should, and some receive less than they should. And maybe an audit of that program is probably warranted. But in some other instances, and in fact, in a lot of other instances, I'm not sure that I'd argue that the sovereignty has actually been eroded. I think it's interesting because I think particularly when you look at BLM land related to some other federal land holdings, if I were Utah and wanting to make this claim, I'd actually say that my sovereignty has been eroded more in places that have stronger designations like national parks or wilderness areas, places that they're not contending are unconstitutionally held, as opposed to BLM, where, the State Fish and Game Agency is the one charged with managing the wildlife out there and issuing licenses and enforcing laws, game laws, and where, the sheriff's deputy can be out there. And if somebody commits a murder on public land, the state has every right to prosecute that murder, just as the federal government can prosecute it for violation of federal law. Now, there's sort of this dual, in some ways, this dual system on federal lands, but there's still sovereignty. There are cases that allow states to assess severance taxes on minerals withdrawn from public lands, for example. A lot of my state's mineral wealth comes from that, the state's wealth. So there are a lot of places where I don't know that you'd say there's a huge diminution in sovereignty, except with respect to two things that Utah, I think, really does point out in its brief and in its complaint, which is taxing authority and eminent domain, where those two things on federal land very clearly do not apply. But again, I'd actually argue that if you wanted to make that the case that the sovereignty has been reduced, that the place to do that more convincingly is actually on national parks, for example, where hunting is prohibited or mineral extraction is prohibited. In Yellowstone, you can't float down a navigable stream. It's prohibited. Things like that, where there's far more limitation on state sovereignty. In fact, in Yellowstone, there's a federal magistrate judge and attorney to handle criminal cases in that park. So I guess that would be my answer. I don't think it's absolute. I think there are some places. Yeah, but the other piece I'd say is that applies to every other state that has federal land of any kind in the country. It's just the magnitude of, what's the tipping point? Is it 5% of land held by the federal government? Is it 50%? Is it 90%? Is it 100%? Everybody's treated the same. It's just over what scope of the landscape.
I agree that the key sovereign powers are the taxing power and the eminent domain power, but I think there are a couple more worth considering, which is defining what constitutes a crime. I think we see as a fundamental role of a sovereign. Now, as David Riley notes, there's concurrent jurisdiction there, right? So the states can still define what is a crime on federally owned land and prosecute those crimes. I think my concern, I think this reflects Utah's concern too, is that on those lands, Utah is sovereign at the mercy of the federal government, right? Because it has It has supremacy. It can at any time preempt that. And, you know, part of the sovereign power to define what is a crime or what to regulate is also what not to regulate or what not to criminalize. So when the federal government criminalizes something that the state has opted not to, I would see that as well as some infringement on the sovereign interests of the state. I agree with David that there's this weird perverse thing where perhaps the land, public lands that infringe on that the least are the ones being challenged. I think that just goes back to this hook of the exercise of enumerated power and whether BLM lands are exercising any federal power that is recognized by the Constitution or not.
Well, picking up on that point, Ethan, one of the questions is whether there's a path to accept federal land ownership and retention, but narrow CLEPI as a sort of compromise middle position so that the feds would have proprietary power over all the land they own, but only get sovereign power if there's that Article I connection. And so I wonder if you've thought about that, whether there's any way in this case that you could collaterally narrow CLEPI.
I think you could. I mean, CLEPI, there was a lot of debate over whether wildlife just conceptually fits within the scope of federal ownership of land. And the wildlife is not land, obviously, and the extent to which, you know, when the wildlife leaves public lands, why should we see it as remaining within federal jurisdiction? So there is a way to decide that case that's really narrow. I think one of the challenges with the CLEPI rule is that it's true, right, that we recognize the supremacy of federal law. I think we could have a world, and we did, I believe, have a world in which the federal government was just seen as a proprietor. It just is a landowner, and it can still be regulated by the state government. We can still have eminent domain. We don't need a world in which supremacy means you can't tax that land. I don't think that that's mandated by the Constitution. I think it's also going to be very hard to claw back that. It may, in fact, be an easier sell to say the property clause just requires you to dispose of it.
Thanks. Another question that's come up a couple times in the chat is, you know, we've talked a lot about BLM lands, national parks, national forests, but not tribal lands. And as many of our listeners know, you know, tribes have sovereignty over reservations. They often have rights to hunt and fish on federal lands, as well as other activities. And I wonder how you see tribal interest relating to some of these questions. Are those lands at stake? Are those rights at stake? And how is that going to play out?
I'll go quickly. I don't think I'll put it into two categories. I don't think the lands that are treaty lands that are, you know, bounded by reservation boundaries, by treaty language between the federal government and the tribes, and those lands that are then held in trust and by the federal government for the tribes as a result of those negotiated treaties. I don't view those as being in jeopardy by this lawsuit. I do, however, think, you know, a lot of these treaties were written in with things like let's use the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868 as an example, right? It has language in there that authorizes tribes to continue to hunt the unoccupied lands of the United States so long as game persists. You know, to the extent that those lands are then sold or disposed of in some way, that potentially affects those treaty rights. And, you know, could bring tribes into claims. Also, to the extent that there's some dispute over what the treaty lands cover, for example, what lands are covered by a treaty, you know, to the extent that the federal government is looking at disposing lands, I think you could potentially make an argument that a tribe could make a claim as a sovereign and the former nation owning those properties, to the extent that the federal government is looking to dispose of those, that they they probably should go to the prior owner, because it would have been potentially a violation of the treaty, and violating the treaty maybe goes back to the prior owner. I don't know enough about indigenous law, tribal law, to really weigh in too heavily on that, but it does feel like there might be a distinction between some of the lands that are expressly articulated in treaties and some of the other lands that retain hunting, fishing, or other cultural rights.
I agree with everything that David said. I'll say that clearly treaty powers is something expressly vested in the federal constitution. This is the exercise of an enumerated power. And then we're going to ask, right, if the federal ownership and management of land is necessary and proper to the exercise of that treaty power and honoring those treaties, where there are subsistence rights to hunt and gather and fish and so forth. We might say that, just the fee title ownership of land by the federal government is not necessarily proper to the fulfillment of that, because we could say, well, look, it's fulfilled by maybe an easement, that the tribal owners would hold to be able to do that. So I think it's a question of under the necessary proper clause, is federal ownership and management of the land necessary and proper to fulfillment of those powers.
Thank you. Well, we're coming up on the hour, and most of the remaining questions all touch the same topic. So maybe we'll use this as a way to pivot to final statements. But a lot of people want to know, what happens if Utah wins? Does the state get the land? Do they have to be sold to the highest bidder? Like, how would this actually work if this federal government had to dispose of several hundred million acres of land?
I'll try to answer that question. I'd love to hear David's answer as well, because I think it's really difficult and people are hitting on the right, like, big whopper of a question that is largely left unaddressed and is a bit of an unknown. If we look back historically, I think it gives us a little bit of a clue. So I mentioned earlier that a lot of states, and David did too, have these disclaimers that seem to say you've relinquished title. So it would be maybe odd in some way, given those enabling acts, to say that federal government, you have to cede the land to the state, because that stopped happening after Tennessee came into the union. I think Tennessee was the last state where they just ceded the federal territory. Otherwise, they disclaimed it, again, because they wanted the money. They didn't want to just give up that valuable land. So I think it's a little bit difficult, therefore, for the state to make that argument that has to go back to the state specifically. In Utah's Enabling Act, it seems to expressly contemplate the idea that the United States would not be selling it or giving it to the state when they disposed of it. So it's there. Section 9 of the Enabling Act says that Utah is going to get 5% of the proceeds of the sales of public lands within said state. And then it says, which shall be sold by the United States. So the Enabling Act seems to at least implicitly obligate the federal government to get rid of it, but not to the state. Because obviously, if it was going to the state, they would not be getting a 5% of proceeds of what they're paying. So I think in this respect, federal government should probably just be seen as a regular proprietor. I don't think that they are legally obligated to give to the highest bidder or any particular or sell to any particular party. It's probably within their discretion. That said, this is just new territory, I think, for everybody.
Yeah, I agree with almost everything Ethan said. The one caveat is I'm not sure I agree with the language from the Enabling Act for the state. Implicitly requires that the federal government sell the land. I think what it is saying is that when the United States decides to sell the land, that a certain percentage of that, 5%, would go to Utah. Similar language to that occurs in several other enabling acts for states. That's not unique to Utah. And I think it's right that was done as a way to because the federal government recognized that there was not just surface value to that, but a lot of subsurface value to those lands. There are a lot of economic value to those lands. But I guess the way I've described it to people is that Utah's claim for relief is that the federal government disposed of land in accordance with state law. And that I don't think is correct. You know, I think the federal government has to dispose, if they're ordered to dispose of, or if it's found that it's unconstitutional and they have to move forward with disposal, it would be, I agree, at the discretion of the federal government, but it would be subject to the laws of the federal government, not the state. And it would be Congress that would have to, frankly, I should mention one other thing. Frankly, there are two pieces of this, because there are two unconstitutional claims that Utah makes. And I think if they prevail on both, it makes it easier to dispose of lands, right? Which is, if FLTMA is viewed as, if the provision of FLTMA is viewed as unconstitutional, that retains land, in the ownership, federal ownership over the long term. What I think that does is, that's, FLTMA is what puts the sideboards and makes it very difficult to dispose of lands, right? Absent that, I think the discretion of the Interior, Secretary of Interior right now would actually probably be pretty great under the property clause to dispose of property in a way that's consistent with whatever Congress has authorized at that point. And we'd have to look at what some other laws say. But I guess the point being, it would have to be done consistent with federal law. But what that federal law looks like, I think, is going to be a matter of Congress to determine how, when, where to dispose of the lands.
Great. Thanks to both of you. Any final thoughts or issues we didn't touch on that you want to briefly mention before we conclude?
I'll just give one thought on the property clause. The property clause engendered very little debate at the convention. It was seen as not a big deal. It would be remarkable for it to have gone through so easily if it meant that the federal government had this grab bag of power, whether it's enumerated or not, with respect to all federally owned territory. It didn't engender debate. The one that did engender a lot of debate was the Enclave Clause, which is a lot narrower. So the Enclave Clause says if you get the state's approval, you can acquire land for a very limited, narrow list of things that Dave mentioned earlier, like military installations, dockyards, courthouses, et cetera. So it's just a remarkable idea to me that this narrow little Enclave Clause caused all this curmudgeonly grumpiness, but the property clause did not. And I think it's because they thought they were just doing something fairly simple, which is saying, look, we've got all these Western claims. We need to figure out what to do with them. And federal government, you should dispose of them unless you're using them for an enumerated power. And this is sort of basic civics. If the government's not operating and federal government's not operating within its enumerated powers, then it's not operating within the constitutional design. And therefore it should either dispose of the land or dedicate it to some enumerated purpose.
David, any final thought?
I think my only final thought is that this is an interesting, I find this to be a very interesting case, and it's going to be one that's going to be worth watching very closely. I do believe if the Supreme Court does not accept original jurisdiction, that you're going to see this case filed in federal district court. And so some of these claims, I do think, are going to be litigated, right? We're going to see maybe some answers to the question. It's the property clause claim that's the most interesting, I should say, which is, in addition to what Ethan said, I'd also say there has been a significant, I can count 7 or 8 U.S. Supreme Court cases over the course of 200 years that really seem to indicate this broad, almost limitless authority of the federal government to, for sure, own and manage properties. And the question of whether, for how long they can do that is maybe a novel one. Although there's some dicta out there that suggests that the limitations on when and how to sell are also, are also left to Congress to decide. It's going to be really interesting to see what the courts do with this, because the implications in my view are so much bigger than 18 and a half million acres of land in Utah. The way I read this case and this claim and the constitutional claim is really it's an implication on 640 million acres across the United States and managed by all kinds of different agencies for all kinds of different purposes. And what that means and how a court addresses the unintended consequences or realities of that is going to be fascinating to watch. And I think the public is just going to get more and more interested, as this develops.
Well, thank you to everyone for joining us on a holiday week and to our speakers for a fascinating discussion. I'll turn it back to Edith in case there's any housekeeping issues.
Yes, on behalf of the Federal Society, thank you so much to David and Ethan for speaking with us today and to Jonathan for moderating. We're so grateful for your time and expertise. And thank you also to our audience for joining us. We really appreciate your participation. You can stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars on our website, fedsoc.org, or on all major social media platforms. Thank you once more for tuning in, and we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the Practice Groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.